Hello, and welcome to the On SOA podcast series. In this special set of podcasts, SOA journalist Joe McKendrick interviews the authors and contributors behind the book, SOA Design Patterns, the newest title in the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle. You can learn more about this book and download sample chapters at soapatterns.com. Also, while listening to this podcast, you can look up any design patterns being discussed at soapatterns.org, a community site dedicated to the ongoing development and expansion of the SOA Patterns catalog. For more information about other series titles, be sure to visit soabooks.com. Now, here's Joe McKendrick.
Hello, this is Joe McKendrick, independent analyst and author of ZDNet's SOA, Service-Oriented Architecture blog, and the eBizQ SOA in Action blog. And I'm here with Thomas Earle, author of SOA Design Patterns, which has just been published by Prentice Hall. Thomas is a prolific author and has published many books in the SOA space, and he is also president and founder of the SOAschool.com, which provides internationally recognized SOA certified professional programs. This is part five of our initial six-part podcast series discussing the SOA patterns Thomas and his colleagues have published. In this podcast, we just talked about the service contract related patterns in our previous podcast. In this podcast, we're going to talk about a very important topic anybody and everybody involved with SOA wants to know more about, and that is service governance. Thomas is going to tell us a bit about service governance patterns he has identified in this book. Thomas, welcome.
Thanks, Joe. And I should point out, we're going to talk about service governance patterns, but there are more governance-related patterns that have been documented. Some are more relevant to the governance of individual services, and some of the patterns pertain more to the governance of collections of services, which we call service inventories. And then there are some patterns that have more to do with the evolution of service composition. So, but the service governance patterns themselves are very important, as you mentioned, because it's each service will undergo its own life cycle, its own lifespan, and its own governance related phases. And being able to design the services in such a manner that they can accommodate that with an anticipation of what they may need to undergo over time really helps deliver each service as a more valuable IT asset, because it will, during its lifetime, place less burden, place less cost and effort upon those that are required to govern it. And it, the most interesting thing to me about this whole process of documenting governance related to patterns, and also in relation to a separate book which right now we have in development called SOA Governance, and there's a whole bunch of organizational patterns that will be part of that as well to complement these design patterns. But what is interesting to me on a continual basis when I get more into the whole governance space over the past few years is how often you can trace governance issues, governance problems, back to the original design of whatever it is you're governing, whether it's a service, whether it's a solution comprised of services, or an ecosystem in its entirety. There are often, very often, design decisions you make at the onset that end up having various types of consequences or repercussions once you're required to govern that, what you end up building. Sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes governance issues arise out of business change and unforeseeable factors, of course. But again, it's very often interesting to see how many of those issues actually do relate back to how you first delivered that service. So in terms of service governance patterns, We talked in a previous podcast a bit about the versioning patterns, so those are certainly governance related. One additional aspect of service governance that might be worth discussing has to do with the granularity, the functional granularity at which you deliver services. What I've seen a number of times, and what was the basis for a number of these patterns being documented, is that organizations, when they first build services, they first explore service composition, they realize that their infrastructure has certain limitations with regards to what it can handle. You create your inventory, service inventory blueprint. You then get this overview of, you know, how many services you're planning to build for that within that given boundary. And as a result of creating that blueprint, you go through a service modeling process that requires you to iterate through the various business processes and decompose them and so on. And that whole phase of a inventory level life cycle, delivery life cycle, also gives you insight as to how services will need to be composed based on the granularity of the services themselves. The more granular the services, the larger the service compositions you end up with. So if you create very granular services that have very specific functional contexts, then it's not uncommon for you then to eventually have to build a service composition comprised of 6 or 8 or 12 services to carry out one task, because you've partitioned the logic into these granular units. But so with that foreknowledge, organizations realize that, well, our infrastructure cannot actually handle a service composition comprised of 10 services, because the more services you have in the composition, the greater the infrastructure demands, the more interaction occurs between services, so the more external and often messaging-based interaction has to occur, the more security controls and reliable messaging controls may need to get involved, the more validation at runtime, perhaps transformation if it's not fully standardized, has to occur. So the more moving parts there are to the overall solution. And so with that understanding, organizations are often hesitant to go to that level of granularity. So they take a step back, and this is why during the service modeling and analysis phases, this is why it's so important for business experts and technology experts to collaborate, because often it's the business experts that provide this ideal vision of how services should be modeled and shaped, and their scope should be defined, and it's the technology experts that can provide that practical reality as to what the infrastructure, what the environment can actually handle. When it's realized that they cannot support these larger complex compositions, the services themselves are the service candidates that are created, that are modeled, are often consolidated into larger, coarser grain services. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a practical decision that has to be made in order for things to be functional at a later point in time. Because it's not just about delivering services for immediate purposes. It's about delivering services so that they can be continually recomposed into new composition configurations as business requirements change. So to build in that inherent agility into the entire service inventory. So you have these coarse grain services you deliver because you have to, but then the years pass. You add services to your inventory. The technology becomes more mature and sophisticated. Perhaps you get more resources or funding to upgrade your infrastructure, and your overall service-oriented environment becomes more modernized. And you realize now that, I can actually support complex service compositions comprised of 10 or 12 or 14 services. The technology is mature enough to deal with all the reliability issues. Performance is no longer as much of an issue because we have applications or appliances and infrastructure now that can handle it, and plus perhaps even the skill set level of those designing all these moving parts has improved, so they can develop more and design more sophisticated solutions. So you're at a point where you look at your services and you go, well, you know, if they were more fine grained the way we had originally wanted them to be, then we would have a cleaner, more flexible inventory that we could compose in more creative ways. But secondly, we could actually improve the performance of our service compositions, because each service exists as its own software program that is loaded into memory And if it's a finer grain service, it'll tend to be a smaller program with a smaller footprint. And with coarser grain services, you often drag a lot of stuff into memory you don't need just to invoke a subset of its functionality. So we look at our service and go, okay, we would actually like to change this, but we cannot change it because all these consumers have formed dependencies on the services, and we don't want to break all these contracts. So that is a governance-related challenge that organizations often face when they are further down the line with regards to their SOA adoption. And for that, there is a set of design patterns that accommodates how to deal with that, that actually have to do with what we call service decomposition, which is the breaking down of a coarse grain service into multiple physical finer grain services. And I can go into a lot of detail about this, but I know we're limited in time, but I'll just call out a few patterns that are relevant to this. Service decomposition itself is a pattern that describes exactly, that provides the formal design solution for what I just described. But an important pattern that supports service decomposition is one called proxy capability, where you can take your original service, decompose it, create multiple finer grain services, move the logic into those finer grain services, but in order to avoid breaking the contract with your existing consumers, you can have that original service continue to provide its original contract and build logic, usually within the shape of a service facade, build logic within the service that acts as a proxy to the new services that you've created that have resulted from the decomposition of the original service. And they essentially act as a liaison between the original consumers and the new finer grain services. And then, of course, newer consumers would not use those proxy capabilities. They would access the new finer grain services directly. Another pattern I'll just briefly mention is called decomposed capability, and its purpose is to actually avoid the situation we just described where you would need to use proxy capability, where you'd need to split up a capability in a way that may not be conducive to how you want to decompose a service. And what I mean by that is you might have one capability, one operation that is part of a service initially, that does a specific thing, but when you decide to decompose that service into two or three other services, you might realize that that operation is in itself coarse-grained, and you want to split it apart into multiple finer-grained operations or capabilities. So with decompose capability, with this pattern, you apply it to the service at the beginning. You essentially model and design the service with the anticipation that you will decompose it in the future, and establish a set of capabilities, many of which are redundant or denormalized, but allow it to be cleanly partitioned later on without having to get into breaking apart individual capabilities, which can be quite messy when you follow a decomposition process. So those are just some additional governance-related patterns. We talked about the versioning ones. There are others, but I just wanted to highlight a few because some governance issues are not as evident as others. Some are versioning related. Some have to do just with the natural evolutionary life cycle of services.
Great, Thomas. And you actually make an excellent case for the whole reuse paradigm. One of the criticisms, if you will, I've heard about the reuse concept is that services that tend to be created by one department often are not a fit for future deployments. The service is created for the need at hand, for the application or the function that's needed at that moment by that one department, and it may not be adequate or may not address the right parameters that the a department making a future deployment may require. Does this help address that challenge with the reuse?
It does. It does to an extent, but I think a large part of that particular issue can also be addressed by how you define the functional context of a service. So its functional boundary. What exactly does the service provide? what is the purpose of the service, and how generic is the logic, and how relevant is it to its overarching context? You cannot predict the future, and you're not expected to when you build reusable services. But what you can do, especially when you invest some time and money in upfront analysis cycles, is you can, based on the current snapshot of the business in its current state, you can decompose your processes and model services as well as service compositions. You create at that stage what we call service candidates or service composition candidates, and you can establish and define and continually refine as you iterate through these analysis processes how services will be reused, how often they'll be reused, how often they need to be reused, how you should partition them to facilitate that reuse. And you do it all on paper without building anything. You're basically modeling everything out as a blueprint and then building your individual services off of that blueprint. And that facilitates the state of the business as it exists at the time you've modeled it. But there are additional factors that go into how you design services that facilitate, that are intended to facilitate how the business tends to change over time. And that actually gets us into a set of patterns called service layer patterns, where we establish these fundamental classifications for services that we call service models, where you can abstract different types of logic into different types of services that have common characteristics. And when you build more of those services, you end up with these groups of related services. They're related based on those common characteristics, and they establish these logical layers within your inventory, and that gets into business entity services and what we call business task services and utility services. Those are three fundamental ones, but you can create your own and derive various service models from them. That separation, what's fundamental is that those three layers, you can classify the services as being business-specific, business-centric or non-business-centric, agnostic or non-agnostic. So agnostic meaning multi-purpose, non-agnostic meaning single purpose. The term agnostic coming from the Greek, which there it's defined as something without knowledge. So when we say an agnostic service, we mean that it has no knowledge of a specific task or process or purpose, and therefore its logic and functionality is useful to support multiple processes or purposes, and therefore is considered agnostic. And so those three layers, those three types of services, have different, they're classified differently based on their business-centric or non-business-centric, agnostic or non-agnostic context. And within those layers, we can establish various types of levels of abstraction as to how we can facilitate future reuse. And actually, I can see on our list that number six on our podcast is talking about services and a separation of concerns, and I can get into more detail when we talk about it there, because we'll really get into the agnostic and non-agnostic service contexts, which are themselves also patterns.
Okay, great. I'd like to thank Thomas for joining us today. This has been a discussion with Thomas Earle, author of SOA Design Patterns, published by Prentice Hall. This is Joe McKendrick, and for more information, we welcome our listeners to check out the site soapatterns.org, soapatterns.org, site with information on the various patterns Thomas and his colleagues have identified and documented to help with your SOA efforts. With that, I'd like to thank everybody, and as Thomas mentioned, we're going to be moving to from here to number six in our initial six-part series on the patterns identified in the book, Exploring SOA Design Patterns and Separation of Concerns.
Thank you for listening to this installment of the On SOA podcast series. To learn more about the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle, please visit soabooks.com. Also, all the books in the series are available online at Safari Books Online, which can be accessed at safari.informit.com.